Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Parker Romaine.
And I'm George Chen.
And you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we talk to interesting people with strong opinions about their favorite documentaries.
On today's episode, we discuss the 2002 documentary The Kid Stays in the Picture by Brett Morgan. This doc traces a meteoric rise, fall, and rise again of legendary Hollywood producer Robert Evans, based on his memoir of the same name.
And we caught up with comedian, musician, and filmmaker Henry Phillips. George, does Henry love this movie?
You bet your ass he did.
We're here with the very funny comedian, actor, producer, writer.
Yeah.
Henry Phillips.
Hello, guys.
Did you say musician also?
Oh, did I not say musician?
You might not have, but yeah. It's become less and less a part of my life, though.
Well, you're a great musician
as
well.
As the years go by. By the way, this is a quick technical thing. You can hear me, right? I just want to make sure.
Yep.
Okay, check.
Smooth,
check,
buttery.
Check, one,
buttery,
two.
Yeah.
I just, you know, we're about to talk about a passionate subject, and I don't want to have to
Amen.
Do it again afterwards.
Yeah.
But I probably could.
Take two. No take twos in this business, Henry.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Happy yeah. birthday. I would sing, George and I would sing happy birthday to
but
you.
But you're the musician. Mm-hmm. So,
but you're the musician.
Yeah. Plus we'd have to pay. Oh, wait, you don't have to pay the royalties anymore
because
it's public domain.
That's right. Finally. Who owned that?
Mildred something or other, and they used it as a soap commercial jingle, and everybody just thought they could steal it, but it was a real copyrighted piece of music.
Mm-hmm. When people would pay the rights to use Happy Birthday, to whom did they pay? Who got the money?
Mildred Pierce, I think, was her name.
Well, she's dead, so it's her grandkids.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess, publishing. It's BMI or ASCAP or
whatever,
Harry Fox or something.
I wonder how much money they made on Happy Birthday.
That's why
sick.
That's why the restaurants you go to now, they have to make up their own birthday songs.
Oh, is that why they do the clap?
Yeah, yeah. Legally, they're
it's
not
your,
allowed
it's
to.
It's your birthday, and
clappy,
birthday
clappy,
is
birthday.
Yours.
Yeah.
It's always terrible.
Yeah, it sounds like something Yoda would say.
yeah, exactly.
Birthday is yours.
But yeah, if you meet a... For guys out there looking for... a sugar mama, if the last name's Pierce, there's a good chance that you're going to be fine.
And I only date women named Mildred, so that
yeah,
helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I like my ladies older.
I'm waiting for Mildred to come back as a name.
Right? Yeah. Henrietta, Mildred, like grandma names.
Yeah.
Now, this is a nerdy thing because a lot of your comedy is song-based, or not a lot of it, but some of it is. Do you do publishing? Do you do all that
stuff? Yeah, I had to learn about that very early on, and it's been great, I got to say, because, you know, I've done a couple of late-night appearances on network TV, and as a comic, you get, you know, I'll just throw out some numbers here. I don't think they're secret numbers or anything, but, like, you know, somewhere around 800 or 900 is, like, the SAG scale or whatever for doing
for
that.
For a day, right?
After a, but... if you're doing a song, that gets logged with BMI. And it's not like the production pays for it. They just say that the song was played. And BMI collects this giant pool of money. And then at the end of the quarter or three quarters later, they divvy it all up to everybody that had songs played. And it's another grand or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and then, so that it gives an extra advantage. And people can abuse it, too. Like, there's... Bryan Cranston, I mean, not abuse it, but in a comedic way, he went on, I think, Kimmel and started whistling. And he's like, you know, I just got paid to write a song and do it on this show. You know? And he told this story about being on Malcolm in the Middle. And in the script, it just said, you know, he's walking in the kitchen whistling. And then later, the legal team came up and said, what was the song you were whistling? He's like, I don't know. I was just whistling. Okay, so you wrote it then? I guess. And he starts getting royalty checks for it.
What?
It's crazy.
That's also, if anyone covers your song, then you're going to get that cut too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. That's
you and like Stephen Lynch probably. Mm-hmm. Also getting.
And the great thing is it doesn't cost the production money, so there's no disadvantage for them. It's just that maybe the Michael Jackson estate gets a little less money because you got some of yours.
Let me ask you about the poor man's copyright thing. Do you remember that?
Where you mail it to yourself?
Yeah.
I did that.
Did you? Is it valid?
I still have it, and it seems so ridiculous now.
The envelope?
From what I understand about copyright law, which is a whole thing, but it is interesting because I did have to learn this very early on because I was a musician and I had this manager named Marty Kaniger who was fantastic and he taught me all this stuff. But apparently something is copyrighted from the moment that you write it. The question is, can you prove that you wrote it? So in the universe, it's yours once it's gone out in the world. Can you videotape you doing it at a club with a timestamp or a bunch of witnesses? If you have an MP3 of a song and you email it to yourself on Google and you can show that you emailed it. I mean,
right.
I'm not a lawyer, but I'm just saying that philosophically these things should work.
Right.
It's just a matter of proving that you did it, but it's yours. And in terms of sending yourself a letter, what was so dumb, and I still have this, and it's so funny. I keep it for nostalgic purposes,
right.
But like in 1989, I wrote this song called Worlds Away, and then somebody told me about this copyright thing. And I emailed a cassette tape to myself, and it was the envelope was stapled together. And I remember looking at it recently, you know, like, what are we, 36 years later, or 26 years later? And just going, well, why don't I just bend the little staples, take the thing out, put another song in there, put in Stairway to Heaven or something, and then or a song that was written since '89,
right?
And then just put those staples back in, and then close them up again. It's like it's so ridiculous that I thought that was going to work.
Yeah.
But I mean, what would you have to do if you sealed it? Then maybe it'd be a little harder to say that you were able. But it seems like there'd be a way to fake that, you know?
I mean, you could steam it open or
something. Yeah, I mean, there's
maybe you have to send it certified or something. Is that?
I think you just need the postmarked. I think you need the date.
But what's saying that you didn't replace the contents of the envelope with something after the fact?
Mail fraud. It's a
felony. They just make the penalty so big that you don't want to do it.
Couldn't you also mail yourself a letter with nothing in it, an envelope with nothing in it that has not been fastened.
You're right.
Right?
Just do that.
Oh. Just do that.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting. Maybe we used to live in a much more innocent time.
I think so.
Well, nobody would do that. That would be really rude.
I used to do this mail scam is like you put the address you want it to go to as a return address, and then you put like...
No stamp,
and then... It gets returned to the person that you wanted to send it to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing.
That's an old scam.
It was like 25 cents. You saved 25 cents?
Yeah, it was a lot back then.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because they would raise it like 2 cents.
Yeah.
Sometimes. It's 47 cents now.
Jeez,
this is a good old technology conversation.
Yeah, this is a good way to engage your listeners. If anybody knows about this,
if you were born in 1989,
copyright thing,
I would love to know
more. We'd
love
to know
more
about it.
Yeah, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
Send us a letter and 919. Okay,
apparently, the original Star Wars was copyrighted that way. That's totally a lie.
So George Lucas sent himself a copy. It was like 44 reels.
Film. Yeah.
And unfortunately, only 43 made it because the U.S. Post Office lost one of the reels.
I know.
That's Rogue One.
Which is why you don't see Chewbacca get killed in the first Star Wars. Like
that's
you're supposed
to. They just had to change it.
Yeah.
You don't see the sex scene.
By the way,
Chewbacca and, no.
I am going to make an interesting segue here because I wrote down that the kid stays in the picture, the documentary we're talking about today, to me, was a link between Robert Evans was a link between old Hollywood and new Hollywood.
Interesting.
He was the bridge between the old school Hollywood method and like the new arrival of the 70s and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of cool that we're talking about old technology, new technology. And one thing we've been, Henry, one thing we've been asking our guests to do is kind of pitch. Maybe you could pitch in Robert Evans' voice. Can you do a Robert Evans?
I can't. If I had just watched the movie right now, then it's sort of, it's such an infectious cadence that you can't not talk that way.
Yeah.
But I don't even want to try.
It'd be more like, you don't have to do the voice, but like the rhetorical
yeah,
style
yeah, yeah, yeah.
of Robert Evans is like.
Did I like the movie? Of course I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would I do it again? You bet your ass I would. Would I watch it again? My pitch for that movie is, when I tell people to watch it all the time, and I'm amazed that people haven't, so many people that are avid film watchers haven't seen it, and I think it's because it's not easy to get. It's not on Netflix, right? It's just like you have to buy it for full price on like Amazon or something like that. I mean, the last time I checked anyway, but it's, for one thing, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful picture. His voice is like nostalgia. It's like we have an actual person talking that is part of an era of Hollywood that's history and revered. You know, his cadence, his accent, everything, and just the power, you know, that he talks with. And it's funny at the same time, you know, it just to listen to. Bob Odenkirk did a fantastic parody of it on Mr. Show, where he was God and talking about Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful pictures and everything, but also it's insightful, especially as now that all of we comics and I guess actors and everybody in this industry have realized what self-starters we need to become to survive. It's really interesting. It's specifically the part in the movie where he says, you know, and we could talk more in detail about it, but when he says, that's what I wanted to be, I didn't want to be some actor shitting in his pants waiting for the phone to ring. I wanted to be the guy who says, the kid stays in the picture and what I say goes. Like, that feeling of wanting to be powerful, self-empowered, not necessarily power over everybody else, but feeling like there's something that you can actually do to make a difference, as opposed to in that situation that I brought up, he was the actor waiting for everybody to decide whether it was going to work or not. That kind of insight is what I love that movie about. And there's several other examples that we can talk about, but I would say overall, not only is it beautiful, it's nostalgic, but it's also educational and insightful.
And it's funny.
It is, yeah.
It's hysterical. I just watched it. I've probably seen this documentary more than any other documentary. I watched it again this morning, and I still laugh.
Yeah.
And I still chuckle at some of the fucking things he says.
Because
he's amazing. Robert Evans
It is a life. It is definitely a life.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's super honest. Like, you would think somebody like him wouldn't portray himself as vulnerable and honest.
Yeah, it's so self-deprecating at times.
Yeah,
he really puts himself out there.
He does, but it's awesome.
And that's almost a show of strength.
Yeah,
to be able to do mm-hmm. that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And as one thing I didn't quite realize is that this was based on a 94 autobiography that he had written. Mm-hmm.
Called it was a book on tape.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Did you hear it?
I think that might have been what Mr. Show was talking about, and the movie came out afterward, and I don't know who put the pictures and the music, added that and some of the old footage, but it just made it even more of an experience.
Right. Oh, I see. So Brett Morgan, the director of this documentary, took his narration from the book on tape,
if I'm not mistaken.
A lot of it is, yeah. Oh. I think it mentioned in the credits, a lot of the audio was...
That's that cadence that he uses is so great because he just owns everything that he's done.
Yeah.
He owns the good and the bad.
Yeah.
The dumb mistakes he made.
But also is a complete... also, it is like an unreliable narrator, if ever there was. I feel like there's a lot of you know, you got to take him out. He was in the room. It was me, Ally McGraw, Stevie Nicks, and we had a line of blow. You know, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's so great about this documentary is that it in itself is talking about old school ways of Hollywood and the fun things that he would get. It's like he's talking about what could be in itself a movie. Mm-hmm. It's this weird thing of like you're watching a documentary about a guy who's talking about his life that could have been a movie in itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about the scenes near the end when they're using shots from Marathon Man of Dustin Hoffman running around just to illustrate like his mania, or the last movie he appeared in as a crazy kooky killer.
Oh,
never seen that movie, but like they just bring in all that footage. And Brett Morgan, like, my only exposure to Brett Morgan is this movie and Montage of Heck. So they're kind of similar, like animating certain things and like using the you know, the first person perspective. There's a lot of stuff came up with Montage of Heck where we're like, did that really happen or was he just fucking with people?
Yeah.
And so he also worked on the new J.T. Leroy documentary.
He did.
So
absolutely.
I think that's one consistent thread is like he just goes with the source material.
What I thought was fascinating. Okay, here's a couple of things that I find is fascinating. One, I didn't realize even back then they were commissioning books to be movies. I kind of thought that was kind of a newish thing, mm-hmm. that books became movies, like graphic novels are becoming movies. Books. I thought that was kind of in the last 30 years. I didn't realize it was even back then that they were doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of repetition. Like, the technology changes, but... Like, for example, when I was studying music, I had a film composer teacher, professor who was like, you know, anybody out there who's upset that the guy from Radiohead did the score for There Will Be Blood.
Oh, Johnny Greenwood,
Yeah. And who might be people that might have spent their entire life working as film composers and they give it to a pop star. Mm-hmm. This has been happening ever since the very beginning. Like, we don't realize that the composers that they used for films had already identified themselves as popular composers in other arenas, like classical composers, like Shostakovich or whatever, and all these guys. Mm-hmm. It's just that it became a different style of music in pop, but they were generally well-known before they were doing the films.
Yeah.
Leonard Bernstein, you know, mm-hmm. had already done his own body of work. Yeah, exactly. Like they were already accomplished musicians in the music world.
Zanuck arrives in Morelia, Mexico, and I'm summoned to show up in the bullring to do my quitas and veronicas in front of him. I walk into the bullring, take off my hat, throw it to him for you. Then I start going through my various things, etc. I feel like an idiot. I know I'm going to get fired.
Aha! Toro!
Suddenly, Zanuck stands up, all 5'3" of him, picks up a bullhorn. The kid stays in the picture. And anybody who doesn't like it can quit. Puts the bullhorn down and walks out.
You can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
In the beginning, he talks about sitting at a pool. He was a business, like a pants salesman or something like that, owned his own business.
Yeah.
And he's like, he references that he's a good-looking guy, which is a hard thing for any guy to say. But then there's a picture of him hanging out at the pool that somebody found, and he is a good-looking guy.
He's like,
you know?
You're like a almost like a ethnically ambiguous Cary Grant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he basically gets discovered, and then he did a couple of acting jobs here and there, and then there's this turning point in his life when he was supposed to play the Matador in The Sun Also Rises.
Yeah.
And Hemingway is there.
That's crazy.
And the director, whose name escapes me, and they were gonna present Robert Evans and say, this is the Matador, and apparently Hemingway hated him. And the director was, you know, picks up his megaphone and just goes, the kid stays in the picture, and if anybody wants to disagree with me, you can leave.
Yeah.
I mean, he says that to Hemingway. and that's when Robert Evans says, that is what I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be some actor shitting in his pants waiting for the phone to ring. I wanted to be the guy who what I say goes. And it's so honest and so great. And it's such a perfect example of a moment in time that changes the rest of your life, you know, and that's what's so powerful about it.
Absolutely. Now, Henry, I don't know why I said it like now, Henry, just thinking about old timey pictures, but can you share a moment with George and I and our listeners? Did you have a break like that where maybe not discovered, but someone where you thought, oh shit, I don't know if this is going to be right for me, came along and your career hopped up from that?
99, yeah. And this is the first one that comes to mind. But like, so in 94, 95, I was a comic / finishing my degree at UCLA in political science. And I had a couple of songs and I would go around and do them. I hadn't decided what I was going to do with my life yet. Had a day job as an English tutor and gave some guitar lessons or whatever. I was pretty much floundering. And then in about 96, I did a show at the Improv that went pretty well, and I became friends with Doug Stanhope.
Nice.
And I admired him so much. I was like, wow, this guy. And I had been to San Francisco at the Punchline, and I saw his headshot there. And I was like, wow, this guy's like, he's famous. He's like the headliner at the comedy club and everything. Yeah. And then we became like drinking buddies. And then in 99, he took me out as his opening act. And I went to Houston Laugh Stop in 99 and featured for the whole week to packed houses. And that was the moment I was like, this is absolutely what I'll be doing here on out.
Yeah.
And I think meeting him, because suddenly Hollywood became this kind of, or comedy became this big playground. It was just like, whoa, you can easily be hanging out with comics that you look up to and everything like that. And so, I mean, that's the first one that comes to mind. That's always been a really big one for me, is making that transition from what am I going to do to knowing for sure.
Right, right. That's the one that put you on the track.
Yeah, and
that's...
then it went down after that. No,
yeah. And where's Doug Stanhope today?
Arizona.
Well, he's making his own books on tape.
And he's fantastic. Awesome, man. I know he's going to be in... Oh, shoot. I think he's going to be in... San Francisco next week.
That's going to be great.
It's going to be way past when this comes out.
But still, I'm just saying for my own.
No, he's got such a strong cult following.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah. And you know, I don't think there's that much of there's a tiny little bit of overlap between those two people. It's just people that take life into their own hands and do it their way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The song My Way, mm-hmm, I think certainly applies to Stanhope, and I think it applies to Robert Evans as well.
Oh my God, yeah.
Sure. And maybe that's a litmus test. If you can listen to the song My Way and feel like it's about you.
Yeah.
I mean, all of us, you know, what the hell are we doing? We're doing it our way.
That's true. And speaking of Sinatra, mm-hmm, like
that was great.
He plays a big part in this this documentary.
Which has been verified in so many other lore retellings of other stories, you know, like Mia Farrow.
Yeah.
Right? And he was the heavy for sure.
Absolutely. It's a great story. I'm going to back up just a little bit though before we get to that point, because I want to go back to the fact that for people who haven't seen this documentary, and if you haven't, you need to. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe just turn this off right now and go watch it and come back, because it's incredible. But so Evan Picon was the woman that discovered Robert Evans in the pool. Mm-hmm. But Robert Evans and his brother had a successful woman's pants business. And then in the doc, he even says, so you could say I was in women's pants, which is hilarious in itself. Crazy. But he says, and I love this word, but he says he's the reason women started wearing slacks.
Oh, yeah.
Is because of his brother. He and his brother had this garment business. Mm-hmm. And I love the word slacks. Because my dad used to say slacks. Go put your slacks on.
Yeah, yeah.
Such a dad word.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Davenport.
Slacks. Yeah, yeah.
You ever, like, go sit on the Davenport with your good slacks.
Yeah.
It always made me laugh.
That's right.
And then, so, yeah. So, A Man of a Thousand Faces.
Right. Story of Lon Chaney.
Jimmy
Cagney stars in it.
Yep, right? His hair and like
first movie.
Yeah, Robert Evans said he was a huge, you know, Cagney fan, and he gets cast in a Man of a Thousand Faces, mm-hmm, and
playing a studio head.
Playing Thalberg,
right?
Yeah, playing a studio head that helps Lon Chaney out, mm-hmm, and it looks like they have some. footage from that movie, and it looks like he's doing a good job. I guess mm-hmm. he says Cagney said, like, "Hey, you're, you know, you're a decent actor."
Yeah,
and
yeah,
something like that. And then he goes on to, yeah, The Sun Also Rises with Ernest Hemingway, and Zanuck was like, "The kid stays in the picture," which I haven't seen. Have you guys ever seen?
No,
The Sun
no.
Also Rises.
I've never.
No,
seen
I've
it.
Read the book, and I kind of want to leave it at that.
Right,
I can't imagine it as a movie.
Well, I guess they were saying Hemingway saw himself as the Matador character, but I thought that he was more the main character in it.
And it's a classic thing too. I mean, you don't have. Well, I'm saying this, and yet I'm going through it right now. But like the writer, it's they have it in their head what the whole thing's supposed to look like,
right? Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to pitch some actor to a guy like Hemingway, who's, you know,
yeah,
whether he envisioned himself or whoever it was that he was envisioning, it's pretty hard to nail that,
right? Know? Yeah, absolutely.
He looks like a matador, though. He nailed the matador part.
Yeah,
he said, that's what he said. He heard the you know that he was on his way out, and he's like, yeah, I became the matador.
I became the matador. Yeah, yeah. He was,
which goes back to he did it like he wanted to do it his way. He I think probably saw that he had one chance, mm-hmm. you know. And you have if you don't make the best of your one chance,
you only get one shot.
You only get one shot. Says
this
Eminem.
Opportunity comes in a lifetime.
Yeah, dog. You know how it is.
Which is true.
Yeah. And it's like you get one chance. George, have you ever been given like a one chance opportunity where you took a moment and was like, okay, fuck it, this is it, and you did well, like you broke through?
I guess I would say the one acting thing that I got, and I had never really auditioned for anything, and it was that thing for Looking, and I had taken some improv, so they just told me to just improv a thing, and I fucked up the line, but it just kept going, and I guess they liked that. But I was trying not to hinge so much on that experience, because it's like, this is my first time doing this, so if I get anything out of it, great. And then, so maybe that, I'd say, because it's like a level of commitment that you get from improv is good in that situation.
Absolutely.
Just, mm-hmm. just commit, and then you'll at least commit to the thing. So
yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, but there's a lot of stories. You know, a buddy of mine did an interview with Howard Stern several years ago on the phone, where he was supposed to be doing a character, and all the writers were telling him what to do. I don't want to say his name just in case, but he's a very talented guy, and he made the choice that he just ignored all the stuff that the writers were telling him, because he didn't think it was that funny.
Yeah.
He's a funny guy in his own right, and he improv'd it, and Howard loved it, and then he was on there a whole bunch since then. So,
oh wow!
Sometimes, you have to go ahead and take your risk. And the writers were like, "Well, you didn't say any of the stuff we told you to say, but I guess it was pretty good. So whatever." But my friend really thinks that it would have gone poorly if he was saying the stuff that they were telling him to say, because it was just kind of cheap stuff.
And Gene Simmons has been on a lot, like you said. Like,
he
keeps going back on.
I know. Yeah, he's
how
been
is
on
he
a
doing,
whole bunch.
Gene?
Gene?
Yeah.
Oh, I think he's doing all right. He's having hair issues, I think.
I think he might be. He is like, it's this whole thing is like this event of good luck and preparation and wanting it.
You know?
Because then after, you know, the kid stays in the picture thing with Zanuck and Ernest Hemingway, he gets a call from my favorite character in this entire fucking thing, Charles Bludendorn.
Oh, yeah.
The head of Golf and Western, who buys Paramount Pictures, which was like the last. Paramount Pictures was like the shit.
Number nine, and there was the
nine
top
nine out of
eight.
Basically, of the studios.
Well, yeah, and then, this is another great thing for people that are looking for insight from looking at his life. But he says, all right, I knew I had to own something. I knew that if I was going to go around and pitch stuff, I needed to be holding something. So he bought for $5,000, I think, the rights to a book.
Yeah.
And how few people that we know, even sometimes including ourselves, are going around trying to sell nothing. You know, it's like he knew he was a smart enough businessman to know that I have to be holding on to something that other people want in order to get people to take meetings with me.
And you're a great guest to talk about this doc with, because you've written and produced your own films.
Yeah, talk about
that. Oh, I think about it all the time. And
Punching the Clown.
Yeah, right now with the we have this movie Punching the Clown. That I would say that was when you asked about the moment that you were given one shot. I mean, I was able to make, with my buddy Greg, we were able to make a feature-length movie, which doesn't happen all the time.
No.
And I really do think we nailed it. That was back in 2008 that we shot it, and it went on Netflix, and then it started a whole career for me. And so now we're making the sequel with a studio. And working with people that paid for the movie, it's difficult because there's always an inherent conflict. There's like, well, Greg and I are trying to make the best possible movie. They're trying to put out a good movie without spending more money on
right.
it, which is all understandable. But when you watch a movie like Kid Stays in the Picture and you see moments like when Robert Evans... I mean, let's face it, the guy had a huge ego.
Yeah.
And what I love is when he's showing the poster for the Cotton Club, and he's got all these investors in there, and he's already done so much in his career by this point, and he's going to say, he's like, I'm going to show you, and you've seen it more recently, so stop me if I'm saying anything that I'm, you know, incorrectly, but he's like, I'm going to show you a poster. If you look at this poster... And you don't say, I want to invest in that movie, then this is not for you, you know. And then he shows the poster, and he's like, one guy, I think from Sweden or something yeah. like that, raised his hand and was just like, who's going to be in it? Who are you, sir? You know what? I don't want your money. If you have to ask that question after you're seeing this poster, yeah. I don't even want to take your money. You can leave right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that's so powerful and awesome. It would have been a better story if that movie wound up being great.
Which it was.
And he even admits, he's yeah. like, you know, and the movie tanked.
Yeah.
But... it's like, that's it. It's a roller coaster, you know? Yeah, and sometimes yeah. you really believe in something and you put yourself out on the line and it turns out to be wrong. And then it's like, you got to eat crow and you got to be embarrassed. It's like, I know how passionate I was about this. I thought it was a good idea at the time.
Yeah. Right.
Turns out I was wrong.
Well, and him and Coppola get in a legal battle over the
yeah.
movie.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and it seems like there's not a lot of love lost between those guys.
No, and he calls him the Little Prince.
Yeah.
Robert Evans calls him, and then the Little Prince took
yeah,
me to
yeah.
court. Yeah.
You know, yeah, but when you see, those are the inspiring things, when you see, and this is another big part of the movie for me, the lasting effect of it is now in this age where a lot of people will tell you that studios are basically bankers, record labels are bankers. They're not, they will front money for an investment and then they'll hope to get it back. They're not the people, the guy who discovered Elvis, you know, Sam
right.
Phillips or whatever,
yeah.
just saying like, you know, I'm going to take this guy, I'm going to go around and make him go on the radio, everybody's going to hear it and it's going to go crazy. It's like Robert Evans was one of those guys too. These are people that just loved the thing that they were pitching so, so much mm-hmm. that they put everything on the line for it. Whereas now it's like, okay, well, who's in it?
Yeah.
All right. So according to statistics, we'll probably make mm-hmm. at least this much money, and there's a chance that we can make more. You know, you balance out the risks and everything. Okay, we'll yeah. pay for it. You know,
right. Mm-hmm.
There's just no passion.
Where's
there's no
the
somebody
art?
Trying to do something that might completely fail, but it might succeed and be the best thing that yeah. change yeah. filmmaking.
It seems like right now people are like trying to make stuff that's going to appeal like internationally. That's why all these superhero movies do well. They can like, we can sell this in Europe. We can sell this in China. It's like an action
yeah.
movie.
Which those movies, I hate, I mean, no offense to all the people that love these movies, but I every time I'm on the plane, I always watch one of them, and they're the opposite of Robert Evans. You know, it's just like they seem like so perfectly calculated so that they've got all the right stuff. And, I mean, they've got these fight scenes that I'm just like, I couldn't be less engaged. I don't mm-hmm. care who wins the fight, you know.
That's when I usually look away and, like, look at my phone for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I could care less mm-hmm. about that stuff.
You know? On the other hand, on the plane, I just saw The Big Short, and I know that's a different movie.
Yeah.
Love that. That mm-hmm. was great.
Yeah,
but it's like,
really well done.
Yeah, there's movies that are made with passion, and there's movies that are made to calculate, you know.
And you said he's a transitional figure, which
well,
I sort of
see
that.
Well, we watch him...
Yeah.
Take what was it,
the producer as auteur,
my ignorance, but Paramount, right? Or
yeah, yes. Paramount.
Yeah, so he takes it from like number eight to like number two or whatever
with
or
a love story.
One.
Yeah,
and it's like it's fun to watch this guy doing that.
Well, he's old enough. I mean, he was there,
like Steve Jobs or something. In a
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
Well, he was young enough to be on the set with Ernest Hemingway,
mm-hmm.
and brilliant enough and just the right age to also then be on the set with people like Jack Nicholson. Dude,
he was doing his 40s right.
Yeah,
this guy lived his 40s.
He was 38. He was 38 when he got the helm of Paramount.
That's nuts, yeah.
Yeah, and that is pretty nuts. And also without much of any history or experience.
Yeah, that script he bought for $5,000 got him a seat at the table. It's basically what he was saying. Like, they could have cashed me out, but I wanted to use this to get invested
calling card,
in the business.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and there's so many, and you can't look at his career and say, look, he did everything right the whole time. There are some people that you feel like you could look at their trajectory and just go, wow, this person literally did it. Like, I would say maybe Steven Spielberg might be one of those guys.
Sure.
It's probably not a lot of mistakes that happen. And that might be an interesting biography, too. But yeah. I don't know if it would be as engaging as Robert Evans, who lost everything several times. Lost love, you know?
But, like, what you're saying, like, he has a passion. As a producer, he's so passionate about the projects that he takes authorship of a lot of these movies.
Well, and what makes
like, it's Polanski and me.
His life movie-ish, movie-like, or an equivalent, is that he had this meteoric rise, this staggering fall, and then a rebirth. I mean, there is nothing more. You read that in every script-writing book. That's what you're supposed to have as a hero. You know? And, like, that's what makes this so compelling. Plus, he sounds like a guy you want to throw back a fucking whiskey with.
Oh, absolutely.
With, you know?
You want to be brokenhearted with him. Yeah. You know? And it's like, the way he talks about his lost loves is just so great.
We had a long two-day honeymoon in Palm Springs. I held Ellie tight in my arms. I love you, Evans. I love you. Forever, Evans. Forever. I whispered back, forever, darling. And promise me, never leave me. I promise you, baby, I won't. Not even for 2 weeks. Not for one kid. I'm a hot lady, Evans. I hugged her. I kissed her. Never change, baby. Never change. And never let anything get between us, Evans. Promise. Promise.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
My stepmom loved the movie Love Story. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, my very first crush was Ally McGraw. Mm-hmm. And if you, which you aren't going to be able to do, but if you would look at pretty much all of my past girlfriends, they all look like Ally McGraw.
Wow. Mine look like Ryan O'Neal. For sure.
Yeah. Which phase? The like bloated alcoholic?
All
one?
Of it. No. I just remember the music when I was a little kid, that song is just fantastic.
Da, 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 yeah. I've actually never seen the film.
Oh, God, I've watched it too many times.
Yeah.
My stepmom was so into that movie.
Have you ever been told you look like Ryan O'Neal? Have
you heard that? No, but I feel like I'm about to. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know if anybody's ever said that one. I've been called Fat Val Kilmer, and he is fat.
That
now,
is just,
so
yeah,
it's just Val Kilmer.
That's a guy who hangs out with Coppola.
I look most like Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi, I've been
told. I can
told
see
that,
that
yeah.
Do you want to tell the Frank Sinatra story from...
You should tell it because you probably it's more fresh in your mind.
So on the set of Rosemary's Baby, which is basically the first Paramount picture that was being produced by Robert Evans. He got a young Mia Farrell. He got his Polak friend, Roman Polanski, to direct it. He really loved the script. But one day he gets a call from Frank Sinatra on the set, and Frank says, listen, I need Mia Farrell off that set December 16th, whatever it was, because we were shooting a picture together. Yeah. Which, by the way, I hope people still say picture in studios.
Oh, yeah.
I hope that is still a word.
It's right there in the title of the movie.
I love it. About. Pictures.
Great.
We're shooting a hologram.
And, yeah, and then so basically.
It's like record.
Mia comes to.
We're cutting a record.
cutting a record. An acetate.
And they're married.
You don't
at
say
the time.
MP3.
They're married. Frank Sinatra and Mia Farrow are married and must be separated by 30 years or something, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Something big.
And he says to Robert Evans, I need. Like, and this is Frank Sinatra.
She's got great taste in men, by the way.
Yeah. He says, I need her off your set because we're shooting a picture together. Mia Farrow comes to Robert Evans and says, I love him, and I'm going to have to quit the picture. Yeah. And then Robert Evans says, I know how to get to a dame's head. Mm-hmm. Ego. So he has his editor cut together like an hour version quickly, and he plays it for Mia and is like, look, you're a star. You are amazing.
Yeah.
Look at all these beautiful close-ups of you. And basically she was like, you're right. And they get divorced. Sinatra divorces her like that week. Mm-hmm. And which is insane.
Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
Amen. He's like, I ain't touching that dame.
Like a dame.
Yeah. And so she stays. And then they show pictures of her dancing and being all hippie-ish and lovely. Mm-hmm. And she's so cute with the pixie haircut and stuff. And,
yeah.
And then the movie fucking goes nuts. It does really well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she wanted Robert Evans to take out a 2-page ad showing what his...
how it opened versus
how it opened versus Frank Sinatra's, which I think he was doing the detective, the movie.
It was the movie, yeah. That's why it was the thing that Robert Evans was like, yeah, like the thing that got me in this business
right.
might take me out of it.
Robert Evans goes on to get the rights to The Godfather,
yeah.
And he basically says there are no Italian American directors in
that's
Hollywood,
right?
And there's only Jewish. The Jewish actors would play the Italian actors mm-hmm. or Italians in the gangster movies,
which
and there was,
could work very easily.
Yeah. Or they used to play Indians, Native Americans. Like Jewish guys would always play Native Americans and stuff. Very
people
weird.
Didn't know what ethnicities were, so they were just like, oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, David Carradine as Kung Fu.
Yeah,
I mean, like it's so random.
It's a lot better now.
Yes, it's gotten it's a little just, bit better.
Tilda Swinton is Tibetan,
right?
And, yeah.
Wait, and then who's playing Ghost in the Machine?
Oh
Scarlett
Johansson is a Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah. Ghost of the Shell. Yeah.
Oh, that's controversial, right?
It is a bit.
Yeah.
It is a bit.
But so then that's what brings in the legend of Francis Ford Coppola into the story.
We had apparently only made 3 movies that weren't considered that successful.
3 horrible movies.
Yeah.
Basically.
Like a musical, which I had no idea he had done a musical
back then.
Yeah, and by the way, when you watch the movie, people out there, you get to see footage. I don't know where they're pulling this out, but just footage of them all sitting around chatting or just like off screen, you know, and it's fascinating. Polanski, Coppola, you know, Mia Farrow, everything. And that footage is another part of the movie that's beautiful, you know?
Absolutely.
The music, the pictures, the whole thing is like a lovely, relaxing experience, you know?
Yeah.
It's really great.
And it's like, I think maybe the first big humble brag.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, like it's like the first modern humble brag. It's so great.
He wanted to tell his story,
you
know?
And if you go, I went to his website. And he has a lot of pictures on his website as well that you can peruse, which led me to tweeting at Robert Evans and said,
Hey,
we're doing Kid Stays in the Picture. We'd love to talk to you as well. And he retweeted it.
Wow.
Somebody.
Yeah.
His nurse took his hand and pushed the retweet button. Maybe. I don't know.
Am I mentioned in this? No.
What's that?
Wait, this is the podcast?
This is on Twitter.
Yeah. You mentioned this podcast?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you put my handle in there.
I did not.
Oh, okay.
I did not. There was enough 146.
I just wanted to be a part of it.
We'll tweet back at him.
Yeah.
We got retweeted by that.
No, it's fun to talk about. I think it's such a positive experience in filmmaking, you know.
There's let's get into the downfall. We haven't got hit Chinatown before we get to the downfall.
No.
We've got to quickly do Chinatown.
Okay, we can rev this up. Yeah. I just also wanted to mention I found out that Odenkirk Saul Goodman is based on Robert Evans.
No, the way he formed the character.
Yeah,
A guy who can talk his way out of anything.
Yeah, he.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he based Saul Goodman on Robert Evans as well. That's where
that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah,
he's got a burner phone. Yeah.
So yeah, so we get into
Chinatown. He commissioned. Okay, so then I read this that he wanted Robert Towne to do Great Gatsby. That's what he hired. He first got to work with Robert Towne, and then Robert Towne has this whole other idea about California and water, and then he shows the script to Robert Evans and a bunch of people, and Evans doesn't really get it, but he's still like, I trust this guy. I'm going to make it, which is that's a big leap of faith.
Well, he calls it Chinese. Like, he couldn't read it, he said. It's like nobody understood the script, which I didn't quite understand what that meant because I'm not sure what was so confusing about
it. I think it can still be a confusing. It's a complicated movie, you know?
Yeah.
So I could see it being without having the visuals of Jack Nicholson doing it. But he already he was writing it for Jack Nicholson, too. Mm-hmm. So that ends up being a huge thing. That's like another thing. He wins a bunch of Oscars.
Yeah.
And yeah.
No, the ups and downs are fantastic to watch. And it's like, it kind of brings up the question, would you in your life deal with all the downs if you had all those ups, you know?
Right.
Or would you be in a cubicle your whole life? You know, there's two options.
There are.
He brings the first down, he definitely brings on himself, which is getting nailed for buying $19,000
of
cocaine.
Medical grade cocaine. Yeah.
And my favorite part of this
he even
is,
says that I was so fucking stupid.
Yeah.
But my favorite part is how he gets out of it. He has to do community service.
Yeah.
He does PSAs.
And it's called Get High on Yourself.
Yeah, which, Aaron, do you remember those?
Henry, I do remember them.
I didn't remember until I watched the doc, and I was like, oh, my God, I do remember those.
It's like, a We Are the World of Don't Do Drugs.
Yeah. As a kid in the 80s.
Because we already did them all.
Yeah. I was so scared of the Say No to Drug campaign. Mm-hmm. Like, that thing seems so weird to me.
And
like,
yet you turned into who you are.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I also didn't try cocaine until my 40s, though, like Robert Evans. Oh. but I think that's also kind of funny, because he's like, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke marijuana.
When I think of Robert Evans, I only think of cocaine for some reason. Yeah. That's like,
well, it's
the first
Hollywood.
Thing I can think
it's
of.
It's Hollywood in the 60s, 70s.
Lady
80s,
Snow.
You know?
Yeah. It got him. It got its, the dragon got its grips in him.
But then that leads to the other thing that really takes his reputation down, which is he is tied into a murder.
Yeah.
Not a suspect, supposedly, but the woman.
He's not even close to a suspect.
It's because this woman wanted a finder's fee for introducing this drug dealer to Robert. And so his name's in the papers regardless.
Because he's the famous one in the whole bunch. And these people in the media, and we're seeing so much of it right now, they want a story and a headline that says Robert Evans, producer, and murder in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Suddenly, everybody just walks away going, oh. Like right now with Brad and Angelina, like, I saw the headline that said, you know, police investigating child abuse reports of Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, now I got to read this. What the hell is this? And then I look, and like the quote from the police is something like, you know, we are seeing no evidence of any child abuse. We are investigating.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you have to investigate if somebody says it. So it's like, who are these assholes putting that headline together? And it sounds like Robert Evans was an extreme victim of this. He didn't kill anybody. Yeah, he wasn't involved in anything. Yeah. Somebody else was trying to introduce him to somebody, and then they got murdered or whatever.
The Cotton Club.
And it ties back to Cotton Club, because Roy Radin wanted to help finance the movie.
Which I think he did. I think, and then he gets murdered, and they tie him because basically in American society, if you're accused, it's truth until proven otherwise, which is horrible.
Yeah,
emails are maybe have something
right. Right. Yes. Well, one of the things that was fascinating was the murder happened in '93. The trial got underway in '99. It's 6 years with him getting some press about it.
The murder is 83?
Oh, 83.
Yeah.
That's right. And then the trial is 89.
Trial's later, yeah.
Yeah, it's like 6 years.
Oh, that's a long time.
Of being, getting horrible press and stuff. So, like.
That woman is arrested and convicted. I think she has two or three accomplices, too.
Is probably why we didn't hear much from him in the 80s.
Yeah. And then, so then he checks himself into a mental institution. And then the story he tells is funny and harrowing, and and it's cut in with pieces of the movies that he's produced, which
right.
is
Marathon very, Man,
very entertaining.
Yeah. Oh, it's so fantastic.
Yeah,
and the one thing that Woodland. Listeners aren't really getting is just the musical way that he talks. It's just so much a part of the movie. It's like its own character. Yeah. It's like anybody else reading their own story would not be nearly as engaging. It's just that that cadence that's such a owning everything that you did and saying it that way. It's so perfect.
I don't know about you guys, but Marathon Man, I love that film, and it's so... so weird, and
I think it's the first movie that I got nightmares from, and I didn't even watch the whole thing. I remember just seeing certain scenes, and then like being like, I am traumatized. That and like Carrie,
yeah,
like Sissy's Basic Carrie.
No, the two movies creepy I movies
couldn't get through.
Then.
Yeah,
the 70s were a great decade for weird, creepy movies.
Well, I mean, that's what I was saying. That other thing about like the 70s, like when you think of movies that changed the course of independent. Well, I guess they're not independent movies, technically, back then. It's just the old studio system broke down.
Well, the movies of the 70s, to me, look like current independent films.
Right.
Like, there was not as much attention paid to whether or not the audience was definitely going to go for this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was more about, let's make a good piece of art.
And most of the actors didn't look like underwear models. They were
like Bruce Dern or someone like that. Yeah,
Bruce Dern. And I mean, like, there's so many of the actors
Elliot Gould looked like a huge
real
star.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's like it's like when you watch a news, if you watch news footage from like the 60s or the 70s, you're just like, wow, these people wouldn't even be allowed on TV right now.
Just Patty Hearst. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He even
yeah.
talked about Ally McGraw's like misshaped tooth or whatever in the documentary.
Listen, snot nose kid.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have Henry's Kitchen, which is a series you do. You have You and Your Fucking Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have
those are web based.
Your movies.
Then I have, two movies, one that's out and the other one's in the can waiting to be distributed. Now, those I wrote, starred in, and partly produced.
Mm-hmm.
And, I feel like at this point, I could never tell you what it's like to be, to have the kind of stakes that some, you know, I feel a little bit, I used to, like, take some sort of joy in it when a movie came out and just fucking ate it. Thinking I'd be like, fuck you, your movie sucked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think it's necessarily the fault of the filmmaker. I'm just sort of like, I'm amazed that anybody can make a good movie because once the money goes up to a certain level, how can you possibly make decisions? Like, people must be scared shitless. You know, it's like what Dave Chappelle went through in the second season.
Right.
You know, once Comedy Central knew they were in for $50 million, they had people standing around in suits telling him what to do.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, that's not the way we made the first one. Right. And I'm just like amazed at how many cooks are in the kitchen and how anything can possibly get done, right. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. What would you do if a studio came to you, let's say like what Louis C.K. got from
FX.
Yeah. What would you, do you have something in mind that you would want to try, or would you take one of your existing?
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of ideas, but to be honest with you, if I got that, and now Louis took a lot less money than normal in order to do that, which was probably smart because that takes away that guilt feeling if you're wrong. You know,
right.
It's like, well, hey, at least we all saved money on it.
Yeah.
You know, and also they probably, that's part of the negotiating of it. It's like, all right, if we're paying you less, but yeah, I would try to take the money out of it as much as possible because then you're going to be afraid. It's like, boy, what if I'm wrong about this? And you can't be. You have to be owning it every step of the way. But yeah, you could make something and just completely flop. I mean, when you're, there's got to be so many countless tales of people making a movie that thinking, like, just picture what goes on. You guys know, I mean, we all kind of in Hollywood know, like, what goes into making a movie. It's like somebody gets an idea, and then if it gets approved, the next thing you know, you've got burly men bringing giant pieces of equipment, cranes. There's all these. Oh, Jesus, guys.
Yeah.
I hope this is fucking good because we're spending a lot of money. A lot of people setting up giant structures and, you know, craft services and chefs and all these other people. Yeah. It's like all to make a giant piece of shit. It's like, sorry about that, everybody.
Right.
You know, it's a little bit nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
You know?
All of a sudden, you have people whose families depend on your movie.
This is reminding me of the thing that we were hearing about from Brett Berg about the Canadians' infrastructure, right. Those like weird tax loop movies,
yeah,
where people are just like, we don't care whether it does well at all,
yeah,
and we're just because it's a tax write off for some people in Canada in like the 70s, just like Cronenberg.
See, that would be a beautiful situation to be in,
right?
You'd probably wind up making an amazing movie, because
that pressure's off.
Yeah, and it, you can't have that pressure.
I was listening to Fresh Air, and she was talking to David Bianculli, the TV critic, who just wrote a new book, and he panned Lucky Louie, the TV show, as a TV critic, and Louis C.K. wrote him a letter that said, like, there's crew that depend on this. There's people's livelihoods that actually depend on this.
And you're ruining their lives.
This TV show. And it, you know, he's a TV critic out of Akron.
And you're just some guy.
Yeah.
Just some fucking guy with an opinion, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I have thought about this a lot because, like, I used to do a lot of music writing, like music criticism.
Yeah.
And I did kind of enjoy taking people down a peg. Yeah. And now, as an older person, I'm like, why? That was just schadenfreude, because it's like, whatever, what, you know, the nice thing you do, it's still someone's dream that they're doing, and you don't need to really shit on them, because it's probably not going to work out anyway, so you don't need to add to that.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's true, and also it might not be their fault that it came out that
way. Well, and it's one thing to have, like, creative and constructive criticism. It's another thing, I was in a band, and we got a review, and she talked about how we looked, and it literally had nothing to do with our music, and she said that I looked like more than Frank Black than not, I remember.
Ooh, okay.
And I was like, oh, you little bitch. I was
looked more like Frank Black than not?
Than not, yeah. So she basically described every member of the band and how they looked. And she's like, bass player, piano player, Pac Romaine looks more like Frank Black than not, or something like that.
Can that be the name of the podcast now?
Yes. I was so mad. I was like, oh.
Yeah, you know.
It's like, what about the music?
Yeah.
Like, describe the music.
Yeah, and when we're in a different era, too, than Robert Evans was in, because chances are the critics back then had to jump through some loophole or some...
They had to be vetted.
Some hoops.
Yeah.
In order to get to be the guy from the New York Times or whatever, you had to probably have certain qualifications.
Right.
Whereas now we're in this era where everybody's just got a website, and it's like... Mm-hmm.
It's Medium, like Medium.com. You can write whatever the fuck you want, and it's going to go online.
Absolutely.
And if you want to write for Paste Magazine, or maybe even Rolling Stone, I think you just email the editor and be like, I have an idea for a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I hope that future generations will become more discerning about where the source of their information is.
But yeah, one can hope. I don't have high hopes.
But what could happen is people will just ignore critics. I think I'm pretty much at the point. I used to read the AV Club all the time because I thought almost every time I loved it. I loved Ebert also. Ebert overall, when he liked something, I tended to like it. Now I don't really feel like I identify with much out there, and I just wait for friends, you know. If a friend tells me, you've got to see this movie, then I'll see it, you know. But reading a review about it.
Yeah.
Well, AV Club is pretty good at, like, going after stuff that deserves it.
Yeah.
And advocating for some things that are under the radar.
The AV Club review of this documentary is really good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's really, it's
that'd
a really good read. And they also do a review of his memoir of the same title, which is also really good.
I really don't know who could watch this and not like it.
I completely agree.
And you don't like pretty things, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like...
Yeah, I was thinking of that visual of, like, even when there's a photo of him smoking, and then you just see that wisp of smoke come up. This reminds me a little bit of also around this, a couple years later, that documentary about Henry Darger.
Right.
This also takes, like, some of his still photos or still imagery and, like, animates it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a big, I think, like I said, I think this ushered in that whole style of documentary filmmaking.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw that technique really used in a documentary.
Yeah. I mean, even Ken Burns kind of used the Ken Burns technique thing of
the slow pan.
But this made a lot more interesting. I mean, it's around this time period, because we've mentioned this already in a couple, like we just did Home, that documentary.
Yeah, Home Movies.
And like 99, we did Hell House. 99, 2000 was still that kind of documentary look where it was like long cuts, not a lot of edits, not a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And it was just what you saw in film. That's all they presented. And then around 2001, 2002.
Kind of early Netflix, yeah. Early Netflix home delivery.
Yeah. Became this changed. New style of, that made it a lot more palatable for people, where I think a lot of people thought documentaries were what you saw on National Geographic or PBS, you know, and it was boring and informational.
This is not boring by any stretch. I was a little bit, I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I started watching it last night. I'm like, I wonder if I'm going to be a little bit bored by this because I've seen it before. And it was like all this shit. I totally forgot that he started as an actor. I forgot all the Ally McGraw stuff.
It works again the second time around, third time around, whatever.
I completely forgot about that murder.
That is.
And the music, you know, what's that one piece they play? I think it's a French song. It's like.
Oh, right. Now we owe royalties on this podcast.
Yeah, no, there we go. But it's like that's a song that Brian I used to hear in the 70s. I haven't even thought about it. It's like it's all nostalgia, you know? It's just amazing.
Yeah, and then at the end, there's a quick synopsis of the fact that he had a stroke
in 98
while giving a toast to Wes Craven, which is also amazing.
That's awesome.
But so what I found out, I did a little digging a little bit more on it. What I found out is that he's in the hospital because he ended up having three strokes. And he couldn't talk and he couldn't really move. And Sinatra had his fatal heart attack in the room like next to him.
Whoa.
In the hospital at Sinai.
Wow.
Here in LA. Wow. And watching them remove his body. Sinatra's body from the room made him want to recover faster and get back to producing and just kind of get back to be able to move and talk again.
Wow.
So that's pretty pretty interesting.
Sinatra plays a big role in this guy's life.
It does. It's weird. Yeah, he does.
Also, if I'm not mistaken, this is external from the movie, but I think that he was supposed to be at the party, the Sharon Tate party.
At the dinner party?
Yeah, and there is a little bit of a Hollywood... cliche that if all the people that were supposed to be at the party that night were there, then there'd be no more people in Hollywood.
Right.
So it might have been exaggeration, but
apparently
they were all hanging out at some restaurant earlier, and everybody was invited, and he just didn't go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And that's when the Manson family killed people?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Where is...
There were only four of them there.
Where is that house?
What
part of L.A.?
I just listened to a whole thing about it. I feel like it was in the Hollywood Hills, Mulholland, kind of maybe.
Did you hear like a podcast talking about the murders?
Yeah, fantastic podcast called You Must Remember This.
Oh, yeah, the Karina Longworth one.
Oh, it's so good.
That is a great podcast.
Yeah, there's like 10 episodes on it, and it's everything you would ever need to know about any of the people remotely related. That's why they mentioned that Robert Evans is one of the people.
Oh, wow.
But a lot of people. We're almost there. You know?
I started listening to all the Blacklist ones she was doing.
Yeah.
All the stuff about the Blacklist.
She's great.
So, have you heard that, Paco?
I haven't.
Definitely. No. Yeah, you must remember this. This is definitely a good podcast to check out about film history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's awesome. Well, Henry.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for letting me talk about this movie.
Did I enjoy this conversation?
Wait, let me
bet your ass. I did.
Hey, George, did you like The Kid Stays in a Picture? Wait, let me do it this way. I'm going to direct to Henry. Henry, was The Kid Stays in a Picture a great doc?
You bet your ass it was.
I butchered
and,
that.
And let's just take a second to be like, where does Robert Evans fit in a world where people look how many Twitter followers you have to know whether you're successful or not? Like, I just love the idea of him trying to wrap his head around that bullshit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe he'd embrace it. I don't know.
He retweeted us. Yeah. So he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
My buddy and I love this documentary so much when it first came out. I mean, he owned a copy of it, then I bought a copy of it. So just quickly, I started a film production company, a comedy film production company called Free Dirt, and we put together a pitch to get money that resembled the pitch that Robert Evans did. So my buddy came in, sat on a desk, and was like, hi, you know, and he talked about our film production company because we would send it to potential people who could send us money. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a great, we have to use the audio from that clip when
he's
talking.
It's great.
He's trying to convince Paramount that, or the GW people that he's, the Gulf and Western people, that he's not wasting their money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Robert, Mr. Evans, dear Mr. Evans, if you're listening to this, George, Henry, and I would like to buy you a drink or hang out.
Who's George Henry?
George.
Oh, I see. It sounds like a famous old actor.
It does.
I worked with George Henry.
The pictures George Henry made. I tell you what.
Whatever you want, a cranberry juice, whatever.
Yeah,
you want it,
yeah, whatever you need. But so people,
so we can drink some Francis Ford Coppola wine together.
Oh, right. If you, for our listeners, check out Henry's Neither Here Nor There, his comedy special.
Yeah,
which you can find on iTunes,
Vimeo.
Vimeo.
And if you go to my, if you go to henryphillips.com, you can find out anything you need to know about me, including the special. And but see this movie if you want to escape watching the news for a little while. You want to return to a fascinating time in our history that wasn't so far away, but feels like it might as well have been. You know, it's really great.
You can buy some purple glasses and watch it
and
that
learn
way.
Something. Let's bring back that time in Hollywood where it was all about adventure and taking risks and putting stuff out there.
And dating
instead of
a
just counting the pros and cons, you know.
Amen. Mm-hmm. Well said. Thank you, Henry.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate.
For show notes and more information about George and Paco's appearances, visit supdocpodcast.com. You can send your corrections, questions, or comments to supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
We'd also like to thank Documentary News for their continued support. Please check out documentarynews.com.
Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
This show is produced by Will Scoville and our theme music by David Siegel.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.